My name is Marvin. I am here in Philadelphia.
I'm Michael. I'm out here in Williamstown, Massachusetts.
I'm Jesse. I'm based out here in the Bay in Oakland, California.
I'm Josh McNeil. I'm based out here in Boston, Massachusetts.
Sad as shit saying that.
All right. So let's get in. Let's just go in that same order, I guess. Let's go into a little bit of rundown of like what is the work that you're doing, and maybe a little bit about like what brought you down this path, how you get involved in social work. So Marvin, you could just start us off.
You're originally from Oakland, California, born and raised. Went to San Diego State undergrad, served 2 years with City Year in Miami, Florida, Boston College for grad school, and now I'm here in Philly. been a couple places. What got me here is just working with low-income communities of color, both kids and adults. There's definitely a need for men of color in the field, men of color everywhere, basically, but specifically in the social work field and in the helping profession. So definitely saw a need. Black and brown boys were being seen as bad or problem children, or you know, whatever negative word that people want to use, and all they really needed was to be listened to. And so I wanted to help out on a larger scale, so I got my master's in social work, moved to Philly, worked with a nonprofit out here that worked with folks that had been shot, stabbed, and assaulted, provided some individual group therapy and advocacy, just helping them navigate different systems. Right now, I work at a school as a school social worker, and I'm also seeing private clients on the side. Hey, and I love this work. I love what I do. I love helping men of color because, you know, we are not always comfortable sharing our emotions. So it's exciting to see that a lot of men of color are reaching out to me for therapy, and we get to, you know, talk some shit out.
I'll get right into it. I'm from Minnesota. Shout out to the Twin Cities, man. I studied psychology at Carleton in Northfield, Minnesota. When I graduated, I got a job at a Fortune 500 company as a financial advisor. I failed my licensing exam 30 days after that, and then I got rehired within the same Fortune 500 company in a different position. Did that for about a year. Hated that cubicle lifestyle. That was not for me. I don't know how people do it, but I learned quickly it was not for me. Got back in touch with a nonprofit organization based out of Boston. They had a residential program in Windsor, New Hampshire, that served children and youth with mental, behavioral, and emotional needs. And I had interned for them when I was an undergrad. So called them during my lunch break and asked if they had an opening during their summer program. Got the A-OK, went upstairs and put in my 2 weeks' notice, and then hopped on a plane and jet set out to the East Coast, Beast Coast. And I got hired within the same nonprofit after the summer program ended, and worked in a school in Boston, and then decided to pursue graduate school over at Boston College for a master's in social work. Worked a little bit as an in-home family therapist, moved down to DC and worked in the foster care and adoption for the Department of Family Services in foster care and adoption for 2 years, actually over in Virginia. And now I am working as a staff therapist at Williams College back in Massachusetts. Kind of moved around a little bit, but still marinating out here in the New England area.
My journey's kind of like all over the place. It wasn't the move to be in therapy. It wasn't the move to be a social worker. I'd actually did my undergrad in biology. I thought I wanted to become a doctor. But when, you know, my first experiences within like higher education, like I feel like that was like some of like the most eye-opening experiences I'd ever had around like institutional racism. Just growing up in like a relatively racially, ethnically diverse community, I feel like being taken out of that situation and then being at UC Berkeley where like folks are hella white, Like, I feel like that was the first time where I really started to piece apart, like, how did the systems work? And so I just really didn't feel like school was for me. And so I didn't want to continue that education, continue on this path of, like, you know, medical school, because that should take hella long. you know, facts. So I was just out here trying different things. And I got linked up with a nonprofit organization here in the Bay, Alameda Crisis Support Services. You know, I got really, really interested in mental health. Was like, oh, okay, like, I could, you know, talk to people when they're going through some real hard shit. Like, do people get paid to do this? You know what I mean? Like, can I do this full time? So I got involved in a nonprofit organization, another one out here, school-based nonprofit, working with youth and adolescents, specifically kids that are like in special ed, on IEPs, things like that, like really intense trauma histories, you know, and I really loved it. Like, I just love working with kids. It was through like that process, I met other clinicians that I really admired, I really looked up to, and they were the ones that kind of pointed me in that direction. They were like, yo, you're really good at this. Like, you should consider being a therapist. Having lived in the Bay my whole life, I was like, let's change it up. And that's how I ended up at Boston College. Legit could not be any more like the exact opposite of the Bay. So that's what I did. And now I've been practicing therapy for about 3 years. I'm still in the nonprofit industrial complex, came back to work at the same nonprofit. And I just submitted my application for the licensure exam on Monday. So,
hey,
yeah, man.
Okay.
Shit, man. I was a little bit of an overachiever. I was supposed to get 3,200 hours. I got about 4,000 of them things, you know? So,
okay, word up. He said, I ain't going to have no rejection on this application.
Yeah, so, you know what I mean? So that's the next move, is getting licensed. And then who knows? But yeah, that's where I'm at.
Word up.
Yep, and I'm Josh McNeil here. Came to Boston from Florida A&M University. I studied political science and English. I originally wanted to go back to Brooklyn, New York, but I thought, you know, let me just take some time away from people that I've already been around. Let me come to Boston and let me get the opposite experience of HBCU. Boston is definitely the opposite of HBCU. And I began and did City Year Boston. I came with the intention of doing 1 year and then going to law school, but I went actually and did 2 years and then went to social work school because I had a program manager, and she was like, you know something, Josh, I know you want to do this whole law thing, but, you know, I know you've worked with kids at FAMU. You do great with, you know, youth here. You know, you've been an activist in Boston, and you're not even from here, and you've been able to teach us about a lot of Black history here in Boston. I think you'd be a great asset to social work, and, you know, you won't be in as much debt. You could probably get more, you know, funding going there, and it's less school. So I was like, cool, let me do that. So I applied to Boston College School of Social Work, where I met my melanated social work brothers. I graduated a year before them. I met my second year, but, you know, BC is again the opposite of HBCU. School of social work, had to mitigate that, move through that. I'm glad that I did. And at that point, you know, I was fed up with Boston. I was fed up with the microaggressions. I was fed up with, like, stuff closing so early. I was fed up with just the lameness of Boston. So, you know, luckily I had...
No happy hour.
they can't spell happy hour in Massachusetts.
Bro, there's no happiness. Like... Let alone we're gonna
have some Boston viewers like, yo, what's good with this melanated social work? What's good with them?
It's only facts, bro. At me.
Yeah. And then after that, after I was done with BC, I went to, you know, work back in Brooklyn. I worked at a nonprofit, an alternative to incarceration program. I was a case manager first in downtown Brooklyn, making sure people, you know, verifying school, verifying employment, doing mental health assessments, making sure that, you know, a lot of case management needs are done. And then within the same organization, I went to, in the same organization, I became a clinical social worker, did a lot of mental health assessments, did a lot of individual therapy, did a lot of group counseling, you know, and it was really fun. But just, you know, I know it sounds hypocritical, but I came back to Boston to just grow my career, my resume. I eventually became working at a hospital, working with those that have been affected from gunshot wounds and stabbing, community violence, doing, responding to different things in the community from violence, you know, providing individual therapy, group therapy, life skills groups, meeting with different trauma surgeons, trauma nurses, just being able to provide a lot of clinical work in the realm of those who have been affected by community violence. And also working at a university here in Massachusetts doing fee-for-service clinical work. And the thing that gets me for this work is just seeing a lot of men that come in through the hospital. We get the back end of things. And I think that being able to be in this work and being able to work with my melanated social work brothers and being able to, you know, realize there should be a lot of front-end work to prevent things. So, you know, I really like the work because I'm able to help brothers do the preventative front-end work to help themselves. And in essence, to help their community so they don't have to, you know, be aggressors in certain things and just to be able to process a lot of different emotions. So, you know, that's what keeps me going in this work.
As y'all were talking, I was thinking about, I know in different situations we've gotten this question. So, like, how did this happen? How did melanated social work come about?
So at the time I was living in Brooklyn. And I think Jesse didn't know that I was coming to his birthday party. He had invited me on Facebook, but I didn't really say or do anything. And my brother was like, yo, you going to go? I'm like, I don't know. Let me just check something out. I just showed up out of nowhere from Brooklyn to Boston. And Jesse was like, you're here? I was like, yeah, man. You didn't even say anything. I was like, yeah, of course, bro. The four of us just took a picture. And then I was thinking like, we're all MSWs. We're melanated. We're social workers. How about we just call it MSW, Melanin Social Work? And that's where it came from for me.
Man, I trust the vibe, man. Trust the energy.
Man, you got to go with that energy, man.
And that, I mean, like, I guess that's where melanated social work as a term started, right? And that's like, you know, following us already being connected for almost 2 years at that point, having met in grad school. What was like, that was like where the term was coined, but what was some of like the lead up to that?
I think it was the graduate student color group. So I think that we all experienced situations in which we were probably the only person of color or the only man of color in a lot of our classrooms that were filled with white females. And so whatever, you know, brought us to that, you know, graduate students of color group, whether it was connection or wanted some free food, whatever it was, I connected there. You know, we had similar experiences, both inside and outside of Boston College. You hear a lot of problematic shit during class and during lectures. And I think that's when you have a group of people that are going through the same thing, especially in a different environment than you're used to, I think you automatically kind of gravitate toward each other. I think we kind of did that. It was a friendship.
Yeah, for sure. I know something that solidified my connection with y'all was putting our social justice kind of core values into practice. And the thing that always pops in my mind is going down to the Boston Commons and protesting after Eric Garner died, after he was murdered, and being out in those streets with about 6,000 people, but with y'all as well. So I know that's something that solidified the bond right there.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, I sit back and I think about that sometimes, and I think especially going back to BC recently and doing the speaking engagement that we did there and hearing about some of the like current students' experience and especially like the students of color and feeling like they, like even within that space, they didn't have a community, not even like a handful of people that they could connect with. Mm-hmm. And I was just talking to Mariama about this recently because she was also out here in the Bay as well. But like, I think, you know, you have to think that sometimes there's a purpose to the way things play out. And I think there was something guiding us in that direction at that particular time, something happening in the universe that all of us just happen to be there at the same time, you know? And like, you look at the political backdrop of what was happening, right? Like, I would say that things were not markedly different than they've ever been. But just the level of media visibility around like violence towards Black folks, and like kind of being in grad school with this like framing of like, this is a social justice program, quote unquote, and just like watching like the Black Lives Matter movement like come into like the mainstream view of like, on a national level, some people are finally starting to engage in the conversation of like systemic racism. I'm just like baffled by the idea that like all these things are happening at the same time and we just all happen to be in this space to receive that together. It's very I don't even know what to put to it, but like divine in certain ways, you know what I mean?
Absolutely. And the fact that we've been able to sustain this relationship, you know, 4 years after the fact, or geez, let me see. Yeah, 3 years after we graduated, four after Josh, you know, that's meaningful. That's real meaningful that we've been able to hold this down and stay connected the way we have.
And folks might not know, but we Skype like pretty regularly, like just to check in and see how each other are doing, just to see you know, how work is going. And I've asked questions and gotten some great feedback about clients that I've been working with. So, you know, we've been probably doing that. How long? Probably like over a year now, right?
I would say three years. Because it started out, we used to Skype every other week. Yeah. And then, you know, it transitioned to being like once a month. But we were all sharing our experience in the professional workspace for better and for worse. Yeah. And I know how just supported I felt being able to connect with y'all and talk about my experience, because I wasn't able to talk about that with colleagues in the workspace, probably because I was venting about them.
Yo.
I always kind of thought too, you know, like luckily we had each other in a lot of the workspaces. You have, you know, people of color that are working there, but you know, what if someone is out there and they're the only, like, they're right. The only person of color surrounded by a sea of like white folks that may or may not understand what that person is going through, and how isolating that is, and how, you know, someone is like yearning for some connection, for, you know, those times when there's a microaggression that happens and they try to bring it up and they just kind of get swept under the rug, or they just kind of say, oh, you're being too sensitive, you know, something like that. So I think this podcast and is going to be hopefully good for those folks, if they can at least hang on to something once a month, right?
Yeah.
That's right.
That's real. I mean, y'all are kind of getting at it already, but I'm curious. I wanted to hear from everyone. Like, what does it personally mean to you to be a part of this, to be a part of like melanated social work? And like, why does it even need to have its own lane? Like, why does it need to be a thing?
For me, it's so necessary having the homies, people I trust, people I love, excel and ascend and show support when we've been conditioned as men to cut off part of our humanity by not showing emotions and expressing feelings. And y'all already know a little bit about my background and my backstory, but like, I didn't have someone who looked like me as a role model outside of the TV screen like that, really. I mean, my older brother was playing ball overseas for 10, 12 years of my life. So he was absent most of that time. And I think that the level of just connection and support I felt from y'all, like, is out, it extends, it's more fruitful beyond just the world of beyond the professional world and the clinical work that I do. Like, the bond is to the core. So to me, it's just so necessary for like my own mental and emotional well-being.
I think similar to what Mike was saying, just for your own personal needs is definitely needed. And I think it's also needed because, you know, where are these platforms? You know, I think social media and this and that are building it off, and it's definitely been, and rightfully so, it's a lot of Black women that are doing it, but you don't see a lot of perspectives coming from men of color. There's not a lot of us in the field anyway. And I think that this is a chance for us to learn, to grow, to call each other in, so we can be better, not only for ourselves, but to be, you know, there for our communities. And it just doesn't happen that often. I mean, you know, the NFL has somebody named Tish Gariner, who is the, you know, over player wellness. She's at LCSW for the Carolina Panthers. And I think that we are now just beginning to realize the importance of having men of color in these clinical fields. And you look at in the NBA, has the National Basketball Players Association that have like their own mental wellness and division or department with, you know, social workers, psychiatrists, psychologists, to be able to talk about these things. Because nowadays, you know, mental health is a real thing. People like, you know, Big Sean, Joe Budden, Royce the 5'9", Josh Gordon. There's a lot more men being able to be vulnerable and to be open and to talk. And they're black and brown. They look just like me and you and the guys that are on this platform. And again, the more we're able to, I maybe it's the wrong word, but I don't know, atone, to have that work within ourselves, the better it just speaks volumes and does stuff for our community. So we'll be able to be our best selves and be more present for our families, for our children, for our communities, for our friends, and do what we need to do as men.
I think for me, it's, I think just simply visually seeing us as men of color in social work is huge, right? Because like in our society, this individualistic kind of view of how to do things is how like that's the norm. And so seeing us together as a unit, as four individuals, and having this, you know, small community, and we're men of color, just seeing that I think is really powerful. I think this also gives us a chance to kind of rewrite, you know, the narrative for men of color too. You know, I don't know if I was in high school or college, if I could name a popular male social worker or therapist of color at all. Mm-hmm. And so it was interesting on Facebook, somebody tagged me. I guess one of her students is on his way to college and said he's thinking about social work. And he's like, he said, you know, Marvin Tolliver, you know, he would be a good person to connect with and potentially be a mentor. And I was just like, oh, damn, I didn't even think about myself like that. But with our following and with, and I'm going to, you know, speak into existence, how big we will get. but younger black and brown boys can look up to us and be like, hey, they doing dope shit. Like, I want to help people too. And so I think that, you know, that's kind of huge. and that's something that I didn't even until that moment a couple weeks ago.
That's real, man. Yeah, I mean, I think as we have been getting closer to like doing this, to recording the first podcast, this is something that I've been reflecting on. You know what I mean? And like next month, I'll be celebrating my 32nd birthday.
Hey,
you. It's a blessing, man. But it's just crazy. Like, I think about like where my journey has gone, and specifically, how has my framework around manhood changed? And I think specifically, I think this group, like y'all, Melanated Social Work, has been like an important piece of that over like, you know, now going on, you know, the 5 years close to that we've been connected. Like, I just, even more so than like the actual daily work of doing like the mental health work. And I think it's starting to fall in place for me, like how much those things are connected. How much are like my own perceptions around manhood and how I'm supposed to show up in the world? How is that connected to my own experience of mental health? You know what I mean? To different things that I've dealt with in my life. And so I hope, like, that's my hope. That's the hope, the end goal, right? Is that through that process, like what y'all are talking about, through that mentoring process, through directly being involved with young people, particularly young men of color, can we make like self-love and self-care and like healthy masculinity as cool as like you know, different things around toxic masculinity, that it's like cool for young men to like take pride in how much pain they can hold in, take pride in like how little they cry. Can we reframe that and help like offer something different that, you know, maybe we can look at the fact that like young men are taking pride in how well they take care of themselves or how well they take care of each other.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. I think you lead into a good segue here because, you know, being pioneers of our own path with respect to being men of color in the field of mental health, you know, we recently lost a champion who was doing a lot of good work in that community, right? Shout out Nipsey Hussle.
R.I.P.
Talk about the work he was doing in the community as well. And I think we should take some time just highlighting that and paying homage.
Yeah. I'm curious, like, what was like y'all level of connection or familiarity with like Nipsey and like his work prior to this, right? Because there's a lot in the media about him right now, but what were you familiar with prior to this situation?
So, I mean, I'm gonna be honest. I didn't really know who he was, and I'm low key mad at y'all because y'all always have your hip hop talk about Nipsey Hussle, and I just listened to him today and like this past weekend. I was like, damn, this music dope as hell. And then I did just some more research about who he was and what he was doing in the community, and I was like, oh, okay, like I get it. So I mean, that's my little bit, but I didn't have too much of a connection, but unfortunately, I'm learning more after he passed and after, learning more about his music and what he did in the community and for his own neighborhood and where he came from, unfortunately, after he had already passed.
Yeah. Has it come up at all, like, Marvin, like, has it come up at all in, like, your clinical work or just in general, like, in your conversations with, like, other folks in the field?
So I work at a elementary, at a K-8 elementary school, so not too much. And then my colleagues are just always working with the school, and my colleagues, my social work colleagues are mostly white women. So, no.
Nipsey Hussle, who's that?
It hasn't come up with my clients or my colleagues. However, I'm going to be giving a presentation about music therapy in 2 weeks. And I plan to highlight some of Neighborhood Nip's community accomplishments and just highlight his presence. So I'm going to bring it to them.
For me, I think I started listening or being aware of him like 10 years ago. I think when Bullets Ain't Got No Name Volume 2 came out. I started listening to him again a little bit after that with like Mailbox Money, with Crenshaw. I was really digging that. Like, Check Me Out. He was doing
Check Me Out. him and Dom, yeah, man.
Bruh, they got so many classics together.
Yeah. Please, man. Make it home safe.
H-Town in My Cup. You know, yep. Crenshaw, all that. The Marathon Continues. The Marathon. I mean, I think his real, like, mainstream or official album, because all those, like, mixtapes and stuff, but listening to, like, Victory Lap, I work out. So, I mean, I was listening to Bullets Ain't Got No Name, or I was listening to, you know, Victory Lap or Crenshaw in the gym, and just hearing about, like, he reminds me, I'm a hip-hop guy, so he kind of reminds me a little bit of, like, a Young Jeezy, but Ooh. West Coast Young Jeezy, talking about where he's come from, you know, moving those packs, but also keeping the squares out your circle.
Right.
How to not be around people that's not really motivating and doing things, just hustling. And the difference between hustle and Tupac, I believe, Tupac was talking about stuff that he wanted to do. Nip was actually doing it. Mm. He was doing stuff and having STEM programs, and I knew this before, for young black kids in South Central. You know, he had his own, you know, store. He had his own businesses and he wanted to buy back the block. And I definitely knew that I knew his bars and I knew some of his discography, but I also knew stuff that he was actually doing in the community. And even I found out that the day after he was murdered, he's supposed to meet with LAPD to talk about anti-violence stuff. And people just respected him. And, you know, he was a Crip, but even Bloods are cool with him. And he just, you know, he had overall respect with everybody. And just hearing about him being Eritrean or Eritrean.
Yep.
And him going back to, you know, his father's land and hearing about how everybody has that communal backing. Everybody, like the family, his family, him having a direct connection and realizing that when everybody eats a meal, everybody stops what they're doing and they eat. And it's about mm-hmm. that. It's about that love. Mm-hmm. And even people that you hear in all these stories about right before he was murdered, he squashed a beef with somebody. That was in regards and reference to his last tweet or whatever. Mm-hmm. Or people that worked there and people found out that he was giving out, you know, food and water to people that worked in the community and people being like, Nip? Nip got killed? Nah, not mm-hmm. Nip. Out of all yeah. the people, all the stuff he stood for, invested back in the block, squashing beefs,
yeah.
and doing that from where he started from and being back. He's not like a regular celebrity that moves away. He was there from jump doing what he can do. And I mean, mm-hmm. it's definitely shaking me because he's like a year and change older than me. So it's like, that could have, you know, he's my age, you know, yeah. he's still relatively young and like, nobody deserves that, you know, and I'm not for the guy, I don't even want to say his name, the guy who, the perpetrator, right, right. the alleged perpetrator. I'm not even for having like some type of street justice, something like that to him. That's not going to bring him back. But like, and there's, you know, everybody has a value to their life, but of all the fucking people.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Not Nip, man. Not Nip. I still can't believe it. But I think now I'm thinking more about his legacy and his teachings and, you know, no person is perfect because I know there are some things about him in regards to being misogynistic or being homophobic. Course, yeah. And those are definitely things that I don't, you know, I'm not standing on.
Yeah. yeah. You know, the value he had, because he looked like, I mean, he represented the street life. And so he looks like the young folks who are out there.
Mm-hmm.
And when they can listen, when you can have someone who looks like you and talks like you, but shed a message that just allows you to think differently, like that is so powerful. And that's what he was doing. Mm-hmm. And I know he's making the waves and the rounds right now. But like you said, Josh, like when I'm in the weight room, he's on that playlist. And that hustle, that motivation right there. Yep. So yeah, no, he the marathon continues.
And one last thing with that. I mean, I feel like it's just, I was listening to Victory Lap and other stuff a few days before in the gym, right? And then I was watching videos of him talking about, or this guy named DJ Academics talking about how, you know, Nip's supposed to be on Everyday Struggle and, you know, they didn't air the show because they just had a falling out. I was watching that and listening to his stuff literally like days before, 3-4 days before. And I'm like, when I heard the news, I was like, I didn't even think about death. I just thought he got shot. Sadly, many, you know, rappers get shot. They put it in the music. I didn't think of death. And when it actually happened, I was in a state of shock.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I think, like, Nip first came on my radar, like, when he made the XXL Freshman cover.
Mm-hmm. Like 2009 or something like that.
I just looked it up. It's 2010, right? And, okay. Like,
He's got some cold folks on that one, right? That
right was a good, yeah, tough, like, tough. I think that's why it's also, like, he kind of flew under my radar. Like, I seen him, and he was there, but, like, I wasn't so into his music. But he shared the cover with, like, Cole, Freddie Gibbs, Big Sean, Wiz, Word. J-Rock. Mm-hmm. Like, this is definitely yep. one of, like, the last decent covers that they did. I don't know. Like, he was just quiet. And I think that's also, like, what is surprising to me was that he was never an artist that you heard about, like, in the media a lot. Like, mm-hmm. like there's a lot coming out right now about some of his philanthropic actions, but, like, he was doing those things relatively quietly. You know what I mean? He wasn't out here announcing it, like, oh, I'm doing these things for the community, whatever, whatever. But he was not the type of artist that was, like, out here, like, beefing with folks at the center of some drama. Like, he was just putting out music, doing it quietly, doing his thing, like, stayed on his hustle, independent, and did what he could for the community. And that's why I think, like, that particularly for me, what is so shocking, you know, looking at the state of hip-hop and how there are just these artists that have totally built their own careers off of, like, creating drama You know what I mean? It's like reality TV within the music industry. And he was like very much the antithesis of that. You know, a real story of growth and redemption. You know what I mean? And I think about
that.
Yeah, I think about there are certain folks that like you think about Malcolm X. Like, you never know. Like, you bring up a good point, Josh, and some of the things that were problematic that came up in, like, Nipsey's content or whatever it is, right? But he was young still. He was still in his early 30s. We don't know. Like, we can't anticipate what was possible. Like, what other changes could have evolved out of that, right? Because, like, you'd be telling a very different story if Malcolm died as, like, Detroit Red. It's like we can't put a fixed amount on like where his growth is as an individual, as a man, as a person of color, and doing his own work around liberation within the community.
That's right.
That's right. I think what comes he died or he was murdered at, you know, 33 like Jesus. And I'm not comparing him to Jesus, let me just say that. But it's interesting that he died at that age. And as a hip hop guy, I think about Nas from One Mic, and he was saying Jesus died at age 33. That's 33 shots.
33 shots. Blocks.
Yeah,
that's
man.
16 apiece. That's 32, which means one of my guns is holding 17, 27 to hit your crew since winning you. And that's what came into my mind about all that. It's just like, what an age to go.
For real, bro.
Young and at 33.
I mean, even the boy JC didn't start performing miracles till later in his life, man. You know, you never know what's possible.
Yeah.
That's right.
Evolution.
That's right.
Marathon.
Yeah. So I mean, like, I think like being within this work, y'all, being within like therapy, within the clinical world, obviously, like, this brings up certain themes that like we deal with on a pretty regular basis. Thinking about like trauma, thinking about grief. And obviously, like, stuff like this, it brings it up, right? Like,
absolutely. Our communities are largely impacted by gun violence.
Sadly.
Yeah. You know, like, I came into work, like, I think that Monday after I found out, and it was like the kids I work with, like, they wanted to talk about it. You know what I mean? Like, it was on their minds because it was something that they had seen, like, on social media or whatever. And so it's like, what do you think? Like, as clinicians, like, where do we go? You know what I mean? How do we support people in processing this, in healing from this? Because it's like that trauma, that grief is tied to maybe the trauma and grief of something that's much closer to home.
Absolutely. And I want to speak on something real quick, because whether or not you were, you know, a Nipsey guru or you hadn't really heard of him until his passing, I've seen people start to shame people, saying, all of a sudden he's got all these fans. And I saw something online that I loved as a counter. It was like, you know, fan or not, I'm a human being who can show empathy. And I can see that a champion in the POC community was lost. So why don't you hold that shame? You're going to keep that, because you're going to have to miss us with that right there. But I love that. And I found a lot of value in that to say, like, you know, whether or not you knew him, whether or not you didn't know him, whether or not it hits close to home, due to how he was lost and taken from us, or it's still something kind of distant. You know, you haven't been impacted by gun violence. We can still connect on this.
Mm-hmm.
And I know healing work can look differently for everybody. And I love the different emotions that come up when we mourn, whether it's anger, whether it's, sadness, confusion, but there's no timeline for our healing process. And I think that's something that we need to hold in mind too, is that we don't have to, there's no reason to expedite it. There's no reason that, we have to move on to the next thing right away. Like, we can take our time with it. And there's just value in being able to grieve independently, but also collectively.
Yeah. I think where like folks start to like have difficulty with that is oftentimes like these instances of like violence or trauma or these like traumatic losses start to stack up faster than we even have the capacity to focus and sit on this moment before something else happens.
That's right. You know, I saw something, I was watching this video about G Herbo, right? Young cat from Chicago. And one of the first videos he put out, his manager had a graffiti artist say, you know what, we're gonna pay homage to his fallen homies. He's like 17 at the time, and he has 19 names on the mural behind him. And I just think about to be that young and to have lost that many people, like to think about when he lost the first one. I don't know the time between everyone who passed away in his life, but it seemed to have happened quickly, right? So Jesse, I think you shed light on something that we need to be paying attention to.
And how do you? I mean, I just had, as you were talking, I thought about this question. How do you help clients make meaning out of that? Out of one or two, maybe it's a little easier. But when you have 16, 17, 18 plus people that have been murdered or that have passed, you know, how do you help your clients with that?
Man,
I think
how do you attempt?
Right.
That's an episode in itself.
You're right.
I think it depends on what gets brought up by that from each client, but I think a trend or a theme that I'm seeing with a lot of this is how do we talk about, so it's a lot of things. It's fragile masculinity. So processing and talking about that, communication skills, and then self-hatred, you know, definitely it's sad that I'm not even trying to go into the whole argument about black on black crime. That's not even a thing because proximity is the whole thing in general.
Right.
White people kill each other too, so let's not over-pathologize us. So, but I think even with that being said, just to process, like, just the self-hatred that some of us, the internalized racism that we have as people of color that we don't talk about enough to process and heal and go through. So, you know, I think that's what was going through that young man's mind at that moment. And I think just him not being able to communicate, him being kind of egotistical to be like, how are you telling me to leave? And then just communication skills. Those are the main things that I see that, you know, we can kind of talk about. I mean, we can talk about the gun violence and as well. But those are the things that came up for me.
Mm. I mean, it's hard for me, man. Like, I'm really trying to mull this over, like, what you pose, man. And I just don't think there's any sense that could be made of it.
Yeah.
Like, and I think about, like, what does justice look like? Because I don't particularly want to see this other young man put in prison. Like, I don't think that is justice. Even if I had a better understanding of why he did what he did, I understand his perspective, but it still doesn't make sense. You know what I mean? Like, I just, like, it's hard for me to reach a point where I could say that murder makes sense. You know what I mean? Like, I just don't think there's a way you could put that down. And maybe there was a purpose there, right? Like, we're all serving some purpose. And I think with my work, like, a lot of folks lean back on, like, what are their spiritual religious beliefs, you know? Because in times where shit just really don't make sense, like, that's it. That's where folks go. Like, that's the one thing that you can rely on because it's built on faith. You know what I mean? Right. Like,
yeah, and I think with the whole religion, well, I don't know if it's true or not, but I was in a visual recently, and speaking about the whole religious or spiritual thing, they said that the meaning of his name meant the God is rising.
Mm.
You know?
I was incredibly moved. Like, I was out in Oakland this last Friday, and Mr. Fab, he had a little vigil at his shop out here on Broadway. And, like, I got there, like, hella late, you know? But there was, like, it was, like, hours after it had already ended, and there's still hundreds of people on the corner spilling out into the streets. Like, thousands of candles laid out, you know what I mean? And folks from every background there, you know what I mean? And just seeing how even, like, this person who was openly cripping, like, how it brought together folks that, like, normally would not come together, you know what I mean? That, like, lie on opposite lines of, like, gang warfare, you know what I mean? But I think I've seen a lot of conversations on social media about like the controversy around the documentary he was making and like conspiracies around the government, which I'm not totally against. You know, we have proof that the government's out here murdering people and shit.
That's right, we do.
Or like y'all brought up like the conversation of like, oh, well, you know, all these people kind of like just bandwagon fans, like y'all wasn't really rocking with them before all this. Woo-woo. But it's like all of this is detracting from the real conversation of what we are dealing with is white supremacy.
That's right.
The conditions that produce this situation, that produce this other young black man picking up that gun and murdering him, yep, are directly connected to white supremacy.
Absolutely.
And so I just don't know if we fully reach like a healing process without addressing that.
It's interesting you say that about like white supremacy and all, and he was a Crip, and people don't know that, like, so he's half African American, half Eritrean. And at the time, I guess in the 50s, 60s, 70s, when a lot of African Americans are coming out to LA, they're coming from like LA and Texas and Louisiana. And some of them started Community Revolution in Progress, aka Crip. And it's interesting that he's a Crip because he was in the community as a revolutionary. And at 33, he was still in progress. It can't get no more Crip than that. You know what I'm saying? Mm-hmm. He wasn't perfect for a lot of stuff, like nobody is. But I mean, again, you die at 33. You are a Crip. You are a community revolutionary in progress. You done all this stuff for yourself. I can say so much about this dude, man. Like, it's just interesting, you know?
Yeah.
So yeah. What about, sorry, go ahead.
No, go ahead, bro.
I was going to touch on kind of what we talked about earlier, that you kind of brought up, is that, you know, you have this individual who is more mainstream, but you have kind of folks in the community that are doing similar things, but they're not getting as much respect. Not respect, but they're not getting the same...
Notoriety?
Yeah. And Jesse, maybe you can speak more to this because I feel like you have the words.
Yeah, I mean, like,
the subject matter was important, I think.
I think I'm just sitting back and observing all of the content that's coming out about Nipsey. And I appreciate that the large majority of it is positive, right? And really framing some of like the positive impact that he had on the community. And folk, like, and even coming from folks that I perceive as like disconnected from like the hip hop community or hip hop culture, right? And so he has made an impact. And for some folks, it's unfortunate that it happened or didn't happen until his passing or until his murder. But I'm looking at that and I'm curious about, do people hold as much empathy for other folks within their community or with who they work with, who are either like banging or trying to get out the life or formerly been in the life, or sometimes folks who are just put in positions that they feel like they have to do certain things, you know, that folks have defined as illegal or whatever that is, just to get by. And is this an opportunity for folks to kind of reframe their thinking around some folks? To be able to open up that empathy, not just to the martyrs, but to their local corner boy, to the local folks working the block in their neighborhood.
I think that we could be more empathic for those that are on the corner and be more understanding. Not to just overlook them, just try to be more understanding of people. It doesn't happen as often. And I think that in the case of Nipsey, I mean, I don't know how much a lot of these, you know, our brothers and sisters have, how much to lose. But I do know for a fact that Nipsey had more to lose than most, regardless of what they were doing in the corner, what they're doing in the boardroom or what have you. And I think with him, he had probably more to lose than most. He had a lot of more resources than most. and he had more money, he had more capital than people with many degrees, with doctorates, this, that, and the third, many years of education. And he used that to invest in the community and buy the block. And I think just his civic actions and his him being an activist, those are the things that, you know, and maybe I need to do more to learn people in my community, but as far as I know, he just has that level of celebrity to have you to realize, even though he didn't put a lot out there, that he had these things going for himself compared to some of our brothers and sisters that's on the corner. Like, I don't really know what they may do or what they may not do. And I can still be more empathic to them. But, you know, he just was in a different, he was in a different space, and he had different platforms and different, you know, opportunities, and definitely way more privileges than many of us, you know?
Yeah. And I mean, like, and I guess that's my hope. That's my hope moving forward, is that I hope that with this tragic loss, one of the things that folks can take from it is that they can then look at someone else's situation a little differently. Would they be still feel as inclined to maybe judge someone, right? And I think this, like, particularly, I think this happens a lot intergenerationally. You know, the old folks always looking at us young folks being like, well, these motherfuckers, they out here wild. Like,
that's right.
But, you know, like, you know, so that level of love and empathy is not only extended to the martyrs, but can we extend that to the folks that are still here struggling right now? You know what I mean? And I think there's this fantasization or this idealization that folks put onto someone's life or onto their character when they're gone, that for whatever reason, like, they just don't have the capacity for when they're still here.
Yeah.
Facts.
It's true.
But with that, I mean, when you take time to be reflective, you know, an event like losing someone often leads to being reflective about that person and what they meant to you and the impact that they had. And we just don't take the time to do that when people are still alive. And because we, for whatever reason, whether it's we feel we can just reach out and there's, we still have access to them, whatever it is. So,
bro, that's real. I mean, appreciate the folks that you got while they're there. You know, I think we're kind of hitting time here. So maybe, like, let's just close it out. Everyone kind of reflect on what's one thing that you're taking away from the legacy of Nipsey Hussle, kind of what he left behind, and how are you going to take that? How is that going to go, continue to move forward and live on through the work that you do? How's it going to affect that?
I see the impact. I see unity right now, and I want that to sustain. I see a lot of people coming together, and I get this sense of momentum. I hope it lasts. I really hope it lasts.
For me, I think it's going back to where you came from, and just trying to make it better. I mean, I know the community where I grew up in East Oakland, it still needs some Black-owned businesses. Like, it still needs a lot of work. And, you know, at some point, I definitely want to go back and help the community that basically created, helped to create myself.
I think what my takeaway is, to appreciate people while they're here, give people the flowers when they can smell them, and just his legacy of just being an activist and somebody who was a giver, a provider, somebody who not only was there for his family, but his community. I mean, his work speaks for itself, you know? That's what I'm taking away from it.
Yeah, and I think, you know, I think the biggest impact that he's had on me and looking at his legacy and his work is just how committed he was to his neighborhood, to his people. You know what I mean? Like, I hope, like, that's something I'm going to continue to aspire to. You know, I feel fortunate enough that I get to work at the high school that I went to high school at. I get to walk those same halls. you know, like that's always going to be the goal. I'm always going to want to start at home, right? Like I want to uplift the community, like where that help uplift me. Like I didn't get here on my own. Like there were plenty of people that played a role in that. And hopefully we can get to a point where we can start to address like white supremacy to a point that like the community, we're holding each other and making sure that shit like this don't go down.
Yeah, definitely.
Yeah.